Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Our guest today is Tom Michaels, professor of horticulture at the University of Minnesota and founder at the Open Source Seed Initiative, pronounced Aussie. We are recording today from Astoria, Queens, Bellingham, Washington, and St. Paul, Minnesota. Our topic or theme today, and I've had Tom on a couple of times, and so we're going to continue along this line, is industrial hemp and its glories. Tom, do me a favor, welcome back, and do me a favor, introduce yourself again and what your background is.
Sure. By the way, hi, JD. It's nice to be on with you again. So I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, in, as you said, in the horticulture area. I've been here at the University of Minnesota for 20 years. Prior to that, I was 20 years at the University of Guelph, so a shout out to Canada. And what I do, well, I have two hats that I wear. I obviously teach. I'm at a university, and I really enjoy teaching undergraduate students. And as well, I have a research role, and my research role focuses on plant breeding and genetics. For years, I've worked with food crops, particularly with dryable beans. Navy beans, for instance, that go into beans and tomato sauce are one of the things that I used to work on a lot, but have branched into other crops as well, working to improve new varieties of lettuce and sweet sorghum for making syrup. What else working with? And of course, as soon as we had pilot programs available for working with industrial hemp in Minnesota, I started working with industrial hemp. And my focus there has been, again, with food uses to a great extent, using the grain for food. So I'm trying to develop new varieties of industrial hemp for production in the upper Midwest.
Well, I definitely want to get into the hemp thing, but you said something there that interests me. You said sweet sorghum for syrup. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
What kind of syrup and stuff like that?
Yeah, so sorghum, we often, if we're aware of sorghum at all, most people have a picture of it as being in sort of arid climates, maybe starting in Kansas and Texas, and used for producing grain. And if you're driving by at 70 miles an hour on the interstate, it looks like corn until you see this tassel at the top and you say, oh, it looks a little different and it's a short plant. And that's because where the tassel normally is in corn is actually where the grain is in sorghum. And so in the U.S., primarily, we grow the grain for animal feed. And that's what it's used for. It's a substitute for corn, where corn wouldn't be able to be produced dry land, and maybe you'd have to use irrigation. Around the world, though, you will find sorghum used for human food, and particularly an important crop in Africa and other parts of the world as well. Now, the cool thing to me is that not only can you do grain from the crop, but there are different types of sorghum where there's a lot of sucrose-laden juice, sugar-laden juice that's in the stems, just as if it were sugarcane. And in fact, it's pretty closely related to sugarcane. So if you, around this time of year, maybe in a couple of weeks, we'll do this here, if you squeeze the stalks and get the juice out, you can boil it down as if it were maple syrup and make a syrup out of it. And it's commercially sold as, oftentimes labeled as, sorghum molasses. It's a molasses-like product that's a natural sweetener. And it's been really important in the U.S., especially rurally, as a rural sweetener. It was actually under investigation by the USDA during the Civil War years when the South was blockading movement of a cane sugar to the North. And needed to have other sources. And there were two crops that were being really closely investigated as a replacement for refined sugar. One was sweet sorghum, and the other was this crop out of Europe called sugar beets. And of course, sugar beets won, and we get an awful lot of our sugar now from Midwestern grown sugar beets. In fact, Minnesota's the largest sugar beet producer in the country. So anyway, I'm single-handedly, I think, in Minnesota, trying to revive the production of sweet sorghum syrup, because it's the sort of thing that if you are a small market producer with direct-to-consumer sales in other parts, like you sell vegetables at a farmer's market or something like that, this is a sweetener that you can make and that you could offer in the winter to co-ops, or if you have a winter CSA or something like that, it becomes another product that you could produce and sell, and it's really not that much trouble to make. So that's kind of maybe a little bit longer story than you expected, but I'm trying to develop new varieties of this.
I actually really appreciate it, because, you know, it's funny, you know, small world, right? I think we've spoke before about how we snowbird, and a lot of the folks that snowbird who are full-timers, we're not full-timers, we're half-timers, you know, they'll do the sugar beet harvest. It's one of the ways they supplement their income, as they go up during the sugar beet harvest and they help out. So you'll find a lot of people who are full-time RV, full-time schoolie, full-time van life. One of the ways they supplement their income, whether that income be Social Security or day labor, unlike myself, who is, you know, in tech, or yourself, who is, you know, full-time, you know, professor or researcher. One of the ways they supplement their income is they call out for the beet harvest, and they go up and they do the beet harvest. What I find interesting, because I knew nothing of this sweet sorghum. For me, it is anything that can increase biodiversity in specifically in the food that we intake, that is not heavily processed, something like a high fructose corn syrup, which in my research is borderline poison at this point in terms of what it can do to your body. You know, anything that we can do to increase the availability, especially of something like a natural sweetener. And one of the things that you touched on was, say, farmer's market or winter crops, things like this. If you're not necessarily wanting to maintain bees, which is something that we do, we maintain bees, so we get honey, this would be a good alternative, it sounds like.
But, it is. It's very multifunctional, too. So it's like honey in that respect.
That's fantastic. I'm actually going to look a little bit more into that, because, like I said, I hadn't heard of it. I've certainly heard of birch and obviously maple and, you know, stevia. There's a lot of different things out there that a lot of people don't realize. And something like this, where not only can you – I mean, this sounds to me like not only are you able to use the stalk, which is great because it's less waste – but you're also able to get grain out of it, right? Yeah. Which you can bake with, cook with, consume, things like that. So it's one of these, without using a trademark term, it almost sounds like a whole food.
Yeah.
Right. So, but back on, you know, why we're here, we are really here this time to continue our conversation on hemp, industrial hemp specifically. Some of the differences between industrial hemp, you know, there's the productive hemp, and then there is, of course, the fun hemp. And then, of course, there's also a third variety now, which I believe is actually available in Minnesota, which is the productive hemp that has been scientist to be fun hemp, but is now legal because of that. Yeah. I think it's like THC 8 versus 9 or something like that, and one of them is technically legal because it's not from quote-unquote cannabis, it's from hemp. But more importantly, let's talk about, you know, if anyone's listened in the past, Tom is very big into hemp, industrial hemp specifically, but we really talked more about the politics of it and some of the more you know, some of the benefits of it, but this, let's go a little bit more in depth. First, just for people's background, are you primarily focused on just industrial hemp now? And are there multiple varieties that you're focused on?
Yeah, I'm doing, in my breeding work anyway, that side of my research, I'm focusing on industrial hemp. And so the difference there, it is cannabis sativa. And it's just that by rule, it's industrial hemp if the THC level is 0.3% of dry weight or less. So it's cannabis that's 0.3 or less THC, and that automatically makes it industrial hemp, regardless of what you use it for. So I'm working with those things. So that includes three major streams of utility. One is, I've already mentioned grain, and we can, you know, talk why that is, especially in Minnesota, but so I'm working with grain. Fiber, which is the classic use that it was put to in the U.S. in the past, and then cannabinoids. So there are these three different streams where it can go. And cannabinoids in industrial hemp obviously doesn't mean THC, because 0.3% is like essentially zero in terms of psychoactivity, but CBD is where people go with production of industrial hemp. It's producing CBD. And you mentioned the production of industrial hemp in Minnesota. The weird rule that came into play when we were talking last time that allowed sales of THC derived from industrial hemp in products, which was kind of is a weird twist. I don't know if this is done anywhere else in the country. It is in Minnesota, where you can grow industrial hemp and then use the THC. And at first you go, well, holy cow, you'd have to have acres and acres of industrial hemp in order to just get a little bit of THC, because it's 0.3. But really what's utilized here is that the CBD is converted to THC. And that is considered a legal type of THC because it was derived from hemp, you know, weird way. That's kind of, by the way, a little, sorry to interrupt you, a little bit out the window, because this past spring legislative session, the state legalized consumption of recreational cannabis. So as of August 1, you're able to consume, you know, within a bunch of rules, right, you're able to do it. So the question kind of now is, well, what's going to become of this hemp-derived THC? And weirdly enough, the legislators created a little pathway for it too. So, yeah.
Well, the hemp-derived THC is actually available pretty much in every single state.
Oh, is that right?
Whether it's legal or not. Yeah.
I've been locked in Minnesota too long.
Well, where I found out this came about was I was in actually Harper's Ferry, which is on my hat here. And I saw that they had edibles on the shelf, and I was like, wait, I didn't think it was legal here. And of course, she had the whole fact sheet right away, just in case, you know, it's legal because A, B, C, D, E, E, F, G. And it's all boils down to it comes from industrial hemp, and it's modified, and they essentially call it a different strain of THC. And I don't remember if 8's the one that you get from the fun cannabis, or if it's 9, but it's one of those types of things where by one number it's legal. So the other thing I think that's important is recently, so Washington, I'm in the state of Washington, and it's, you know, we had medicinal cannabis for a long time. And then in an effort, which I think was brilliant, in an effort to make sure that they could collect the taxes, they rolled it underneath the liquor board and then made it, if you're 21, and basically it's got the same rules as liquor. You got to be 21 and over. You can't carry a firearm into the store. Just like you can't take a firearm to a bar, those types of things. And now they collect taxes on it, which is brilliant because, you know, the war on drugs is kind of silly. I mean, just tax it, take the money, and do what you need to do with it. But the point of that is, they have realized, you know, you said 0.3%. Well, non-alcoholic beer is only 0.5%. If you drink enough of it fast enough, you still get the effect, right? And if you think about normal THC, someone who is a recreational user, something like a 2% or 2 milligram, I should say, is more than enough to get you, you know, like you've had a beer a little too fast. So it just depends, right, on how fast you take it and those types of things. But one of the things that I've been really impressed with is that even your more populist medical sites now, like WebMD, because I started looking into how can I get CBD, and like, because now you can go into any store and they're like, I have CBD cream and CBD lotion and CBD drinks and all this stuff. And I was like, I've always understood, whether rightly or wrongly, that in order to truly get the benefits of CBD, you needed at least some THC. And as I've done research, even WebMD at this point is saying, no, look, if you have a real CBD product, not, you know, that's been tested, it can help with inflammation, it can help with epilepsy, all these types of things, which is kind of a great thing, because last thing we need is more big pharma if we have natural solutions. But let's focus on, we've talked about the plants you're specifically focused on, and you mentioned in your intro what you're trying to do, but let's talk about that a little bit. What is, in the past we've talked about crop rotation, and you've also talked about fibers to a certain, textiles to a certain degree. Give me, has your focus changed or anything since the last time we spoke?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how it's been changed is when we spoke before, I was likely harping on the idea of us really wanting additional farmers wanting, not me wanting, farmers wanting the additional diversity you just spoke about earlier, right? So diversity on farm is a good thing. It's good for the soils. It's good for the economy of the farmers. It's good for the community, yada, yada. It's really, so diversity is great. But what do we see instead? We see up here, we see corn and soybeans. You know, that may differ a little bit in various parts of the country, but it's still the rotations, the diversity is pretty low. And that's not because farmers are saying, I only want to grow corn and I only want to grow soybeans. It's because farmers have pencils and they know how to calculate what's going to give them a living wage and what's not. And so they're not going to grow things that are not profitable and don't contribute to their bottom line. So corn and soybeans do, for a million reasons that, you know, is probably another podcast, but not only have they had a lot of science gone into their yields and productivity, but the food system is geared to them to a great extent to use those products. We're used to certain foods. I mean, it's the whole food
system
is geared toward these sort of things.
Let me interject there, because I think you allude to a good point, but to be specific, you said the food system. If we're talking about the agricultural system of the world, but definitely of the United States, chances are, if you buy food instead of grow food, if you are buying from a box, you will be ingesting one of two ingredients, corn or soy. Period. And that might be in the form of corn starch. It might be in the form of high fructose corn syrup. It might be in the form of quote unquote vegetable oil, which is normally actually soybean oil. And it's really created a monoculture, not only of food, but of the nutritional content that we intake and what our bodies are actually able to gain from that nutritional content. And not enough people, and I, without going off on too much of a tangent, our education system is largely to blame. Not higher education, but lower education, in terms of basically teaching people buy from the box, and that's thankfully coming around to start thinking about, you know, are you eating food or are you eating food adjacent? And the chances are, if you are in an aisle, right, if you go into the supermarket, doesn't matter what it is, but if you are in an aisle and you are pulling stuff from a box or a bag, you are likely eating food adjacent. You are not actually eating food. And it likely has corn or soy or both. Okay, I will step off my soapbox at least for a moment. Yeah, off that rant.
off that rant. No, that was good. And you're absolutely right about the education. 40 years ago, when I started teaching, my first course I ever taught was Agronomy 100 at the University of Wisconsin. And I taught row widths and planting rates and all that sort of stuff about how to grow crops, and for a range of crops, but that was the focus of what I did. I now teach a plant production system. It's not exactly Agronomy 100, but it's in that sort of realm. And our focus has completely changed. Part of that is because our students have changed. Our students are not, the number of rural students is really small. People off the farm going to the farms way different than it was 4 years ago. But we talk about the food system, the very thing you're talking about. So it's not just what's happening on farm. It's talking about the inputs that are coming onto the farm, including the energy embedded in those and what it took to produce those and the impacts of that, as well as what happens on the farm, the off-farm source pollution, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, but also how these things are then utilized. And we work a lot with food processors and how it gets converted into something that becomes, as you were calling, food adjacent. Understanding that whole package, I think, has become a much more important piece of what we try to do now, in part because we are trying to develop thinkers who understand the whole system rather than how do I change row widths.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, I turned 50 this year, and I can remember the original food pyramid versus all the hype when the food pyramid changed. And then looking as someone who is now entering the later stage of life, trying to make sure I stay healthy, and you turn 50, what do? You go to the doctor. And the doctor said, okay, man, you're not 35. We need to adjust some things. And one of the things that we had to adjust was, on June 6th, I was 240 pounds. Now, I am not 6'5". I am not Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I am now 220. And I'm thank you. And I have a goal of 195. But a good portion of it was just, looking at my diet, right? And it's not that I ate anything bad. In fact, I didn't. We're actually really good about that. It's how much, right? Do you realize how much bacon you're actually consuming, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you also get confronted with that decision, right?
Well, I can go on. Yeah, and I'm not anti-science. Well, let's be honest. What we're talking about here with industrial hemp, there is an enormous amount of science going into ensuring that the crop can work nicely within the soils, can be harvested appropriately with the same machinery as corn and soy, and the economics of it, all that comes into play. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the only medicine that I am on is Advil occasionally, as well as some Voltaren for some arthritis in my ankle. And I would much rather do that than be in a scenario where I'm taking this medication for diabetes or this medication for high cholesterol or this medication. Now we have the obesity drugs. I don't want to do that. I'd rather just be a human and take care of myself unless there's no other choice. Right. So let's continue. I mean, we've talked about the differences between hemp and marijuana. Yeah. It boils down to THC content. I mean, the plants are, because you can get sativa heavy marijuana,
right?
So we need to be clear there that there's plenty of sativa heavy cannabis, over 0.3% that is quantified as marijuana. And in fact, if you're going to consume, I actually recommend the sativas because it doesn't make you melt into the couch. the indicas, you're kind of just give me chips, right? But Let's talk about, you know, now that cannabis and marijuana, you know, industrial hemp and cannabis, you know, they're becoming largely accepted. I mean, the majority of states either have a recreation or at least medicinal program. And the states that don't need to recognize that everybody's doing it anyway. So just get over yourself. But how is that? How is the legalization? I mean, I imagine that. I mean, in reality, except for maybe Arkansas, by the time I'm 60, all 50 states, there's probably going to be a federal program, right? Just like there's federal legalization of certain alcohol and things like that. So how is that adjusting for your research in hemp? Is it helping it? Is it making it more accepted? Does it seem more viable? Are people talking to you about, hey, forget fibers, let's talk the fun stuff, right?
Yeah, well, we're in that transition period here in Minnesota right now, and I'm not sure quite how it's going to sort out. But I'll just give you one really quick story, and that is that around 2019, there was a huge shift in industrial hemp production in the state away from grain types to CBD types. That was the time. That was the 2019 was kind of like that boom year, where everybody grew way too much, and then it sat in sheds. So, you know, maybe there's still some sitting around now from 2019. So anyway, that was kind of the boom and bust, but it really did shift. And even today, we have far fewer acres being produced in Minnesota of industrial hemp than we did then, but 60% of it is still for CBD. And in talking, I don't talk to all the growers, but I've talked to several, and it's, In a sense, one of the things they're doing is using the CBD crop to get their chops ready for growing THC crops. And so I'll be really interested to see if in subsequent years, as how many growers transition from being CBD producers to then producing CBD, THC. So in Minnesota, the way the legislature was done was to try to encourage small producers, those who outdoors would grow a half acre or less, and indoors would grow, I think it's 2,000 square feet or less. So small, craft sort of stuff, trying to keep out for now, some of the big players. I was actually talking to one of the big players just earlier this week saying, is that going to keep you out or not? Because it just the fees are tremendously higher for the big companies. But on the other hand, they're better capitalized and maybe it's not a big deal. But anyway, so we'll see what happens to those growers, JD, whether they stick with the hemp-based CBD or whether it's going to go to THC. And I think we're going to lose a lot of them to THC production. Now, the other side of that is that we have been doing some work with CBD plants, especially indoors in our program. I don't breed them, but we're doing some research on production, and particularly the ability to recognize stress easily. Before you can see it by eye, can we see it robotically with image analysis and stuff like that, robots going over the crop. And so that has gotten me into this space, into the cannabinoid space a little bit more. And because of that, I'm starting to get some feelers from folks in the state who are looking for outreach about their production, their THC production, home production even. I had one guy write to me and say, gee, Tom, I live kind of close to your breeding plots, your industrial hemp breeding plots here in St. Paul. If I grow in my backyard, am I going to get seeds off your plot? So, you know, they're aware of what's going on. And by the way, the answer is yes. But what can you do? And like, you can grow indoors if you want, but you know, or you can still use the crop with a few seeds and it's not a big deal. But you know, we're seeing that transition. A year from now, I'll be able to tell you whether we were kind of sucked into it. The university's in this weird situation, JD, where here's this prohibited crop, right? Had been. still in some places. And all of a sudden, the legislation says the University of Minnesota is going to consult with, they call the cannabis management group here in the state, Office of Cannabis Management. We're supposed to consult with them on best practices for producing the recreational crop. Now, if that isn't a sea change, I don't know what is, because we are going from never being able to talk about this, never being able to touch it, and having it be illegal and, you know, stuck in the closet or something, literally. Now all of a sudden, we're helping support people with how to grow it. It's fantastic. It's just so crazy, a system.
So, two things. One, the way you said growing in the closet makes me a little suspect about your youth.
Man, I went to college in the 70s. I don't know.
And two, you know, it's interesting. So last time we spoke, you talked about, you know, using hemp originally as the third rotational crop with corn and soy, which of course will increase biodiversity of the soil, which means more nutrients. And one of the things that has really come about recently is like regenerative agriculture and publicizing, which is something I don't think that Big Ag wants us to know, or even the government wants us to know to a certain degree, that there is a direct correlation to the quality and nutrients of the soil to the quality and the nutrients of the plant.
Sure.
This is why if you grow at home, you grow a tomato, and you actually are able to grow a tomato, which is a lot harder than you think. It is so much more flavorful and so much more nutrient dense than, say, something that you're getting from the store, unless it's, even if it's organic, frankly. But talk to me about the, for lack of a better term, the architectural structure of the plant. And what I mean by this is, so if you want cannabis, you are likely distilling something from the flower, okay? But there's also hemp fibers or cannabis fibers, and the, you know, and sometimes I think they call it shake, which you can get some THC from some of that. But there's also the hemp hearts, which would be, yeah, I assume, the seeds.
Sure.
And then commercially, you have what's called, you know, hemp protein or hemp flour, which are essentially the same thing. And we'll get into what those are specifically in a moment. But would it be possible, for example, let's say we have a cannabis plant, and let's say it's, you know, 10%, whatever, of THC. Is it possible to use the whole plant? Meaning, can the THC hearts not have THC, but the flower has THC, and then of course the rest of the plant can be harvested for, say, textiles? Is that a possibility, or are we really talking about two separate
things? Well, let's break that down a little bit, because I'll start out by saying it's possible, but it's probably unlikely to happen in today in the way that we have developed the varieties. So we've channelized our cannabis varieties based on their single use rather than their multiple use. So maybe in the past it was a multiple use crop where you could drive cannabinoids and you could do some fab for textiles, and you could eat the seeds or feed the seeds, by the way, to cattle or something like that, or poultry. But everything's channelized now. So there are fiber varieties, and there are grain varieties, and there are cannabinoid types. Like, for instance, if you just, let me take an extreme, an auto-flowering cannabinoid type that grows 3 feet or less or something like that, you know, that's a really specialized plant for THC production. And so it's going to really emphasize flower production. It's going to have a lot of trichome density and all that, relatively short stems. And so you really wouldn't be able to harvest that for fiber, and no seeds, because who wants seeds in their flower? So we've kind of channelized things. If we were to do I'll take you on a virtual visit to my hemp breeding plots right now. But if we were to, you and I walk out into, I'm pointing out the window here, out to my breeding plots, you would see that I have one field where everything's really tall. And the distance between the inner nodes, between where the leaves are attached, is quite, maybe not that much, but that much, a little over 8 to 10 inches or something like that. And that gives you really strong, long fibers, which are great for fabrics. I take you out to another field where we're breeding for grain. And there you would see something looks a little more familiar, a little bit more like cannabinoid types, where it's really dense with flowers. The height of the plant isn't that all important, but in this case, it's heavily seeded, and I'm going for high seed density rather than high trichome density. And I wouldn't be able to take you to a cannabinoid field because I don't have one of those. But you'd see all of these really stark differences because we're very channelized. Now, your question is, could we? Absolutely. Well, with one minor difference. We could breed plants, and wouldn't be that terribly difficult, that have high THC content in the flowers, but are still quite tall. You mentioned sativas earlier, and that general category of plant tends to be taller, although it's another discussion about whether sativa versus indica means anything from a scientific taxonomic standpoint. But that aside, we use those terms to denote certain appearances of plants and certain effects that they have. And so in that sense, I consider them valid terms. But sativas tend to maybe be a little bit taller and later maturing and thinner leaves and all that sort of thing. Well, we could still, they still have flowers, obviously. You could use those for fiber. Where it comes to the seed, seeds generally, seeds don't produce trichomes. You got to have trichomes to produce cannabinoids, and those are really abundant on the bracts surrounding the seeds, but not the seeds themselves, the bracts surrounding the seeds, and on the sugar leaves that are associated, little small, either single leaflets or very small leaves that are really tied in with the flower, those get a lot of trichomes too. When you get the fan leaves, though, they're like waste because they generally don't get much on them. The seeds themselves don't have THC. The only reason they would is because they've come into contact with the bracts during threshing or something like that. But it's low enough on the seeds that they're now informally considered by the DEA as being industrial hemp, even if they will produce a high THC cannabis plant, the seeds themselves are below 0.3. And so you will see this claim being made by U.S. seed banks who are distributing seed and saying, well, based on a letter that came from the DEA, this stuff's considered industrial hemp. So I'm selling you industrial hemp seeds. Just so happens it's going to grow a regular plant. So anyway, the seeds, just to finish the story, hemp hearts are not going to have any THC because there's no trichomes associated with it. And if you take those hemp hearts, the way you get hemp hearts is you take the hull, you take the seed coat off the seed, now you get a hemp heart. And that's the cotyledon, the embryo, it's all there. It's a whole grain. But if you then take the oil out of it, the oil makes a good edible oil, by the way. It doesn't have a super high smoke point, so you wouldn't use it to fry your french fries in it, really. But it would be a good oil that could be used as a salad oil, like olive oil, but maybe a little less flavor to it. But it's good that way. You take the oil out. Now you're left with this thing called press cake, which typically is fed to animals in other, like in soybeans, because it's high protein. But you can extract the protein from that and make a protein isolate. And that, to me, is kind of the magical product in terms of driving consumption maybe, and also driving demand that will create large acreages of hemp. That protein isolate's really special because, you know, you were talking before about boxes. You look at a box, it's going to have corn or soy something. And oftentimes it's soy protein isolate, right? Or taking the animal world, whey protein isolate. But if you could substitute hemp protein isolate for that, all of a sudden, the market just explodes, and you would be able to justify having 100,000 acres of this in Minnesota instead of 300 or somewhere, whatever we have now.
So outside of the, you know, we've discussed biodiversity of crops, crop rotation, soil health. Give me the economic benefit, or forget the economic benefit, the health benefit of this hemp protein isolate. What can, if it can replace soy, for example, what is the benefit, the direct benefit? What can I say? This is awesome because it doesn't do X, which soy does.
Soybeans really a fabulous plant too in many ways, but there are two effects that typically come up that folks point to. One is allergenicity a reaction to soybean protein isolate, and the other is the mimicking estrogen effects that come from soybeans. Now, I've recently heard that estrogen mimicry has been debunked, but I have not looked into the literature to make sure about that. And it was coming from some food scientists who might like that to be true. I don't know. So obviously you and listeners shouldn't say, oh, Tom said it's, you know, mimicry isn't a big deal. It certainly is in people's minds. And I don't know where the science is on it right now. But those two things, sometimes the science doesn't matter, right? It's what people think. And there's concerns about allergenicity, and there's concerns about estrogen mimicry. Now, and the third thing that goes beyond and starts talking more about the food system is hemp is not a legume, which is the family that that soybean comes from. Mm-hmm. It's not a grass, which is the family that corn comes from. It's a third family called Cannabaceae, which is the only other plant that I know of that's used in that is hops are in the same family. And when you have different families growing in a field, they tend to extract different types of nutrients, put different demands on the soil, which improves the resilience of the farming operation from an environmental standpoint. It still puts strain. It's not as if hemp doesn't put strain on nutrients. It uses a lot of nutrients too. But It's using the soil in different ways. It's adding different things back to the soil. That's where diversity is important. It's not like all of a sudden we have this miracle crop that grows strictly on air, but because it's using different things, it improves the resilience and the ability to maintain soil health a little bit better. So human health, but soil health too.
So there's a couple I've recently been exposed, you know, firsthand, not me personally, but firsthand experiences in my spouse, as well as some of her network, they're called spoonies. Have you ever heard this term, spoonies? Okay. Spoonies are people who have chronic conditions. And the term was coined because a spoonie, you or I, we can go out through our day and maybe we take a nap, maybe we don't. If we need to take a nap, we are regenerated, have a cup of coffee that we can power through, right? A spoonie cannot. A spoonie has a number of spoons available to them throughout their day, and everything they do takes a spoon. So when they run out, they're done. And that might happen at 4 p.m., it might happen at 10 p.m., it just depends on whatever, you know, they're going on through their day. The reason this is of interest to me is because the spoonie closest to me, my wife, has what's called MCAS, which stands for mast cell activation syndrome, as well as a couple of other things like fibromyalgia and stuff like that. But this is the one that's pertinent to this conversation. What MCAS does is, generally speaking, a person will be allergic to food or to plant, well, pollen, right? It'll either be grass or, say, dairy. MCAS makes your body think you're allergic to pretty much everything.
That's tough.
Okay. And when I say, and not only that, depending on the day, will depend on how your body reacts to X, whatever X, Y, or Z is. The only thing that we know for a fact that she's actually allergic to is grass. Now, this, which is a common allergy, but grass in this particular case, because of MCAS, here are some interesting things that happen with her. Normal people, if you ferment something down or distill something down, for example, you'll see like liquor that says gluten-free. Well, of course it's gluten-free. It's been distilled, right? I mean, it's a marketing ploy. It's ridiculous. But fermented items, you can be sensitive to something that's in a fermented item, say a beer or a cider or a wine, but not necessarily have an effect. But with her, if she has, for example, a lemongrass cider, even though it's been fermented and it's basically a beer, but cider, ears explode. And the reason I bring this up is, as we've been trying to find ways for her to have, normal diet, healthy diet, those types of things, you brought something up. Soy, which is a lugwean, which means bean, and corn, which is a grass.
Right.
There's not enough research done because it's so rare, right? These conditions that we're talking about are not, it's not, oh, I've got tennis elbow or whatever. These are very rare, weird genetic derived things. But based on this discussion and research that we've done over the past couple of years with this, you really have to start wonder, how do we supplement food to get her what she needs nutritionally without exposing her to certain foods that she's going to just by default be sensitive to? Well, that's one of the things that I find interesting about hemp. Now, soy is a complete protein. So is hemp. But hemp is not a lugine or a grass, just like you said. And it gives you a couple of things that soy doesn't. Now, obviously, soy is edible, but it took them hundreds of years to make it that way. Whereas hemp is just, it's like picking up the fern top, right? Fern tops are edible, right? Look, I've got hemp. And it gives you three very core things, which I think are important here. One, hemp fiber/protein provides protein at a very good level ratio to caloric, caloric to protein ratio. Two, fiber. And three, iron, which makes it particularly useful for, say, vegetarian or vegans, especially since iron obviously has great effect, but also adverse effects for digestion, which is what the fiber takes care of. So to me, anything that we can insert into the food stream that creates better diversity for nutritional content is valuable, very valuable. And it seems like hemp is the logical choice, because if we can find a way to produce the nutritional content and the protein isolate that you're after, and then you add the fiber textile, and then you just by default get the benefit of biodiversity, what's the downside? And that's the question to you. There's got to be a downside, because so far, whether it be industrial or the fun stuff, I have yet to see a downside.
The downside, the very practical one, that is the downside right now, is markets. As I was saying before about, growers know how to use a pencil and figure a profit. Right now, it's a risky crop to grow. It's a risky crop to grow because the markets are not established. If you were to grow corn, you would have any number of machinery dealers who would be happy to sell you really focused equipment on corn production. You could go out and buy that stuff. You could also very easily, once you harvest the crop, You'd be able to store it on your farm with very focused storage equipment. And most of all, you'd be able to take it to the local elevator and sell your crop, because they will accept it. It and soybeans, you know, everybody accepts those things at their elevators. Well, not so with hemp. That infrastructure doesn't exist. If you want to grow hemp, let's just say for hemp hearts or something like that, if you can't do it all the way to putting it in a package, you know, do it, if you're not vertically integrated on your farm, then that means you're going to need to sell the hemp seed to someone who can then make the product. And that's, who is that? You know, there are places, but are there any in St. Paul who can do that if I grew here? Or so where I'm going with this is, you have to also be a marketer if you're a farmer. And some farmers are great at that. And some farmers, that's not what they do. They know how to grow plants really well and grow a crop. So they want to be able to grow a crop, have the infrastructure in place, take it to the local elevator, write a check, done, you know, on the move. That isn't there right now. And it's kind of, JD, it's like a chicken and egg thing. Like, it's the classic problem, right? You need the markets before you get the crop, but you need enough crop to be able to develop the markets. And we're caught in that right now. And somehow we have to figure out how to break through.
Okay, so obviously your focus is Minnesota, which, you know, makes sense. And anything that we can do to, increase the quality yield of your farmers, that's what we're really talking about, yield and then economic value of the yield. But I'm curious, would your research be helpful and I have to think about this a little further, but would it be helpful, for example, for cotton farmers in the South, right? Because they're already integrated into the textile industry. Is there a benefit to crop rotation with cotton with hemp? And or perhaps is there a variety that, for example, that maybe grows shorter, because cotton doesn't grow very tall, right? Is your research, is there a possibility there in terms of outreach? And the reason I bring this up is because maybe the problem isn't the chicken and the egg, it's the farm, right? Maybe it's, we need to start at an area that's already driven by textile production that would, and thus we see the benefit, and then it can move north because hemp can grow pretty much anywhere.
You know, JD, that's an astute observation you made. And that is that there are regional crops are regional for a reason. Like, there's a reason that peanuts are grown in the South and not up here in Minnesota. And at first you might say, well, that's because it's too cold in Minnesota. And it's not really true. I mean, we could grow peanuts in really good peanuts in Minnesota. We grew them in Ontario, Canada, commercially, and you could do it, but the infrastructure isn't there. And so your argument kind of is, well, instead of me moaning about the infrastructure not being here, how about if we get the crop started where there is an infrastructure? And I have, and I think you're right in terms of like textile mills, to the extent that they still exist in the U.S. There are still some, as I understand. There is the understanding of how to produce those fabrics, if that's where we're going. And so there's some logic to what you're talking about. Maybe the rotations should happen with cotton, because heaven knows cotton's a tough crop on the land. It has its own big insect problems and disease problems, and so having a rotation crop makes sense. And you've also, frankly, exposed one of my weaknesses, is I do focus on the upper Midwest almost exclusively. And so I believe that actually there's more fiber hemp. If we were to take a look at how the crop is utilized, the industrial hemp crop is utilized around the country, I think there more is produced for fiber in southeastern states than is produced for fiber up here. Very little up here.
Yeah, I mean, and the only reason I even thought of it, honestly, is because, you know, every year when we do our around the nation trip in the winter, one of the things we end up driving through is cotton fields in Georgia and things like that. And I was just thinking to myself, you know, every shirt I currently own is either bamboo rayon or hemp. Oh. And yeah, I don't, I find for shirts now that cotton is just, once I had bamboo rayon and hemp, cotton felt
heavy. It's actually how you feel. I thought maybe it was a political statement for you about
No, not at all. It purely about, well, part of it was about sustainability. I wanted to see what alternative fabrics that were natural were like. Because I will not wear polyester. I mean, polyester just sucks the testosterone out of you. Mm. I mean, scientifically, that is known. Traditionally, I just wore cotton or wool, right? That was it. But in my experience, wool is good for one thing, socks and thermal, right? That's it. Base layers and socks. And I was looking for, alternatives to that. And I started with the bamboo rayon, just because I'm wearing bamboo. Yeah. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right. But then I realized, although it is a natural product, it is a man-made product. It's very, very processed. And so I went into the hemp location, the hemp direction. And to me, it's a very good middle ground. It's not quite as durable as cotton, but it's definitely more durable than the bamboo rayon. And so when I'm driving through these cotton fields, I'm thinking to myself, you know, cotton's been here for literally, you know, hundreds of years. It's a staple producing crop for the Southeast. Is there a way that we can accent, augment, produce a better, I don't want to say better, but a different crop that has certain economic benefits, right? There's cotton's grown like Egyptian cotton, right? It's grown everywhere. But if all of a sudden the Southeast is able to shift at least part of it to be a hemp capital for textiles, that suddenly starts opening markets in the vein that you're talking about, which is all of a sudden machinery is modified to, say, support cotton and hemp. And then suddenly that starts to move a little further north. And now we're talking about taller varieties of hemp and corn. And then by default, because of that, we have soy. And then it kind of moves north, right? As the mass migration of humans are going to move north because the South is becoming uninhabitable, right, over the next 50 years, perhaps the crop rotation north ends up benefiting your research in the longer term.
You know, one of the things I'm learning about how we're using fiber in the Midwest is it's not for textiles, which surprised me. I'm kind of interested in the textile use, just because I am. But the way that hemp fibers are used now, and by the way, just for your listeners, the fibers are around the outside. So this is I have one sitting here because people come in my office. This is the interior of a stem, where's my fiber? Anyway. And the fiber is around the outside. So the fiber isn't like in the middle or anything like that. It's right around the outside, wrapped around the green stuff. You just kind of pull it off if you want to. Those are called bast fibers, BAST. And it just means that they're fibers that are associated with the plumbing of the plant, the vascular system that moves water up and nutrients around and all that sort of thing. This stuff in the middle, botanically, it's called the cortex of the plant, which just it's parenchyma cells. It's just plant cells that are really high in cellulose. So this is the stuff that's really great for making paper. If you've heard of using hemp for paper,
this hemp paper,
cellulose, just like paper. So it's wonderful for that. And the way this stuff is used for fiber producers in Minnesota is primarily that along with the bast fibers, without being taken off, the whole thing is retted or rotted to allow the fibers to separate a little more. And then it's decorticated, kind of, It's run through a machine that cracks up this whole stem when it's dry, which takes a lot of effort, and chops it up. And then those pieces are used for, so the fibers now are very short, and the herd or the cortex is all chopped up. It's used for building materials. Like, you've probably heard of hempcrete, right? But it's also used.
Yeah, I was literally right, just going to bring
used
that up.
For big mats that are used along highways to help get grass established when they've put in a new bridge or something like that. Or it's used around here, they're experimenting with its use in insulation because it has an R value. So all of those sort of non-textile uses of fiber and the stem of hemp is really being explored now. And the one that I'm really interested in hearing is when people start picking up more and more on the where it was going in the 1940s before everything got shut down for various sort of bioplastics, for instance, being able to use these things as a natural, you mentioned rayon. Well, there are some that are cellulose-based plastics. We always think of oil-based plastics, right? But cellulose-based plastics are a thing too. And I would love to see this transition into this being used more as a crop in composites. So I think those developments are down the road and may happen.
Well, you know, it's funny. You brought up two things I was going to bring up. So as someone who builds schoolies, right, school buses that are converted to motorhomes, one of the often things is, how do I insulate? Okay. And there's three most common forms of insulation in a conversion. Now, a school bus by default will come with your standard yellow fiberglass or some kind of insulation. It's not really for thermal use as much as for sound. And most people will either use like styrofoam based insulation with a reflective backing. They'll use the solid core pink stuff. That's what we used. But a lot of people, those who can afford it, will use wool, which is great because wool is mold and mildew resistant. It's insect repellent. It's fire retardant, right? It's useful for that. But a new thing that's coming around is hemp. And people are starting to use hemp. You can get it as baffles, or you can get it as just, you know, you throw it in there. And in building, I literally just this week watched a short documentary on, you know, eco building, and hempcrete came up. Now, one of the interesting things about hempcrete is that it's all but fireproof, which, of course, you know, unless you're building a big concrete building, is actually kind of nice. You know, it's nice to have something that, you know, one of the problems with how we build our homes now is, whether we like it or not, our homes are full of poison. Now, they're not poison by default. They're poison if they catch on fire, or if you aren't wearing a mask while you go into your attic, those types of things. But they are largely built from poison. And a lot of the stuff that we use day to day, the screen I'm looking at right now is Gorilla Glass, right? I mean, it's all industrial-based composites, and it's not necessarily good for us or the environment. So anything that we can do, like you said, you know, using hemp to build all kinds of things. Another one that I found interesting is that so we've been trying – where we can, we're not crazy, but to pick when we buy things to be intentional about what we buy. So in our school bus, for example, all of our cups and plates look like plastic, but they're made from wheatgrass. Right? I see the same value there in hemp, right? Because hemp is such a universally usable thing, from the oil, which can be burned as biodiesel, to the food-based product, to the textile-based product, to everything else, building materials and everything else we're doing with it. It's one of the reasons your research interests me so much is that you are, it's not the funny part of it where, oh, he's actually working with low cannabis, right? It's the value of your research for the future of everything that we're doing. And I just don't think a lot of people understand it, right? Because plastics is supposedly easy. And, you know, with it. Okay, short rant, and then we'll wrap it up. Okay? It bugs me that I have no problem with profit. I run a business. I love profit. Profit is what pays for this $1,000 tablet that's sitting in front of me that allows us to run this podcast. Okay? I have no problem with it. What I have a problem with is we have taken the things that are literally most valuable and essential to the survival of not just our species, but all species on the planet, and we have devalued them. We seek cheap food. Therefore, we don't have food. We have food adjacent. We seek comfort and the ability to Netflix and chill. So nobody thinks to themselves, you know, no, even in a dense metro area, you can still grow tomatoes in the window. If everybody, like, if you're perfect example, producer Lindsay, she lives in Astoria, Queens. I don't know how many floors, but there's multiple floors in her building. Right. Imagine if that building got together and level one said, we're going to grow cucumbers. Level two said, we're going to grow cherry tomatoes. Level three said, we're going to grow lettuce. And then for 4 months to 5 months a year, everyone's trading their food and everyone's getting free salad. Why don't they do that? It's because there's other priorities. And I'm not taking away from their priorities, but what I'm suggesting is that those priorities aren't their priorities. They are the ugly arc's priorities to generate more profit. That's my short rant. Just grow some food, right? And with what you're doing, you're literally trying to make the world better through agriculture and other things, but for agriculture. You're working on a plant that says, I can provide you with building material. I can provide you with food. I can provide you with biodiversity. I can provide you with fun just by planting a slightly different kind of seed. And that seed can still produce textiles.
Yeah.
Right? And medicinal benefits. So, in short, how do we come up with, and this is why I brought up the South, right? How do we come up with the plan that makes it so that we're not 25 years to market? Because let's be honest, neither you or I are young men. And we're 5 to 7 years to market. That is my mission for you and I for our next episode, is to produce something that says that benefits your research to make it viable, to make the research to market faster.
I think it's a good plan. I think it's a good plan. You know, one of the things that I'd like to see happen first, small steps first, and yeah, I know we need to do it quick, but there are some small steps that we can take that that I've found are kind of helpful. And one is to start destigmatizing the crop, because still it carries the war on drugs stigma, whether folks are around for war on drugs or not, the attitudes tend to be there. And the attitude that I'd really like to develop, have people feel, is it's a plant. Doesn't have all that baggage. It's just a plant. And one of the ways we do it is, you know, I was taking you on this virtual tour of my research plots. You can just walk out to my research plots. They're surrounded by some of that sweet sorghum because I need to grow that stuff anyway, so I put a ring around it. But you could just walk out there. There aren't guards, there aren't gates, there aren't fences, there, it's accessible. Well, and I really don't have problems with people trying to take some to see if I'm kidding or not when I say it's not going to get you high. You could walk into my greenhouse, and I'm not saying this so that people come and raid my greenhouse. You could walk into my greenhouse and just walk in and take a look at the cannabis plants. Again, it's all industrial hemp, so folks aren't going to get high off it. But it's accessible. It's around. I try to take it to my so that we treat it like a plant. And the other side of this is, as people in legal states start to grow their own where that's legal, there's because it's been stigmatized or because it's so hush-hush, it's like it's an unusual plant. We have to do unusual things with it. No, really, treat it like a tomato. Yeah, there's some messing around with it to get it to work. But if you set aside this thing about I have to have the highest THC possible, just grow the damn plant and learn from that, and just keep learning as if it were a tomato, as if it were a radish. It just becomes part of your life. Now, what's that going to do? I think it can destigmatize in the long run the utility of this crop, so that this message that you were saying about the multiple uses of it and the benefits of the crop. We haven't even talked about some of the environmental benefits of it beyond rotations that are there. It makes it a more accepted crop. And boy, that's a good start right there. Just let's start accepting this thing as having potential.
All right, two final things. One, I agree with you 100%. Destigmatizing it is important. The problem is that we've literally had, what, 50 years of the war on drugs, a proven failure, evidence-based failure, not political, evidence-based failure, research after research after research. The problem is, this is a rough one. I believe that you should have wisdom to serve as a representative. Okay? When you don't have wisdom, you end up with, without saying names, certain people, it doesn't matter the side of the aisle, that are, frankly, they're radicalized for whatever reason. It doesn't matter what side. That's number one. But the senior wisdom providers of our representatives grew up in an era that was pre-war on drugs that was even more critical. And then when the war on drugs came out, it gets cemented into their ethos. When you have leadership that still believes that cannabis makes you crazy, that's why we're. Now, government should move slow, don't get me wrong. But we're at a point now where for a long time it was states had rights, and then we morphed into this federalistic, the federal makes all the rules, and now we're kind of coming back around on certain things, obviously, because marijuana is still federally illegal, and yet the states are basically giving the Fed the finger, thankfully. We got it comes down to who we elect, right? Because it's who we elect that is going to be the people that are like, okay, hold on a second. You're telling me to follow the science, but you're not following the science. So can we follow the science for everything, right? And recent pandemic included, right? So there's that. And I completely lost the other one because we were talking about the federal government. And whenever I get into politics, I just try to keep myself under control. That being said, I really enjoy talking with you, and I would love to have you on again and discuss, because we have, I think this
Yeah,
is episode
sure.
three, I
Yeah.
think, that we've done with you. And we talked about biodiversity, we talked about nutrients. I definitely think that we should get into what does it really take to grow this? Because there is a concern about water consumption. There's a concern about carbon capture, capture. So what are the other benefits we're dealing with when we talk about ditchweed or industrial hemp or whatever? And then explore ideas. Maybe we can get someone else who is in the agriculture, or maybe we even get one of the someone who's really into the recreational side, and we do a panel or a three-parter or something like that, where we can kind of brainstorm how can we move this forward for not the hippie benefit, but the actual better benefit of economies of scale, capital markets, investment, nutrition, all of it together.
I'm in.
How's that sound to you? All right. Awesome. And with that, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Tom Michaels, professor of horticulture at the University of Minnesota and founder of the Open Source Seed Initiative, pronounced Aussie. I recommend everyone look that up. It's an important mission. Was our guest today. And out.
Thanks, Jamie.
Tom, that was awesome, fun, man.